Previously on Beta.
I like new money. I don't know if you do, but I hate old money that's wrinkled and dirty and got all the diseases on it.
We've got a duck season, a deer season, but we don't have a flu season.
Someone with similar intestinal problems. We've seen several people being delivered from the colostomy bag.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. And this is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
He was sort of a pioneering cultural figure at a time in which there was really no space to stand in the place that he wanted to stand.
He was Larry Norman, the father of Christian rock. Norman's fans include Bono and Black Francis from the alternative rock band The Pixies. But chances are that you've never heard of Larry Norman. I hadn't until very recently. Gregory Thornberry will join us today to talk about the life and career of Larry Norman and why he still matters. Also, if you watch the HBO comedy series Silicon Valley, you're familiar with Jin Yang.
And your app uses the same machine learning to recognize if a food is a hot dog?
And a not hot dog. It's very important. It's a hot dog, not hot dog. It's technology.
We'll meet the actor who plays him, Jimmy O. Yang. But we're going to kick things off with Nell Scovell. Nell has spent over 30 years working as a TV writer, producer, and director. She's written for many famous shows, including The Simpsons, Late Night with David Letterman, and Murphy Brown. She also created and executive produced Sabrina, the Teenage Witch. She's got a new memoir out called Just the Funny Parts and A Few Hard Truths About Sneaking into the Hollywood Boys Club. Nell broke into Hollywood by writing an unsolicited script, a spec script, as they call them in show business. The script was for Gary Shandling's late 1980s sitcom. The show was called It's Gary Shandling Show. So why did Nell Scovell choose to write a spec script for It's Gary Shandling Show?
It was absurdist, and that was always my favorite kind of comedy, whether it was Monty Python or Albert Brooks. I saw his movie Real Life, and that is what made me think I could be a comedy writer. So I send this script in, and they buy it. And I end up flying to Los Angeles, and I meet with Gary, and he pays me this compliment where he tells me, "You write like a guy." So that was the late 80s, and I think there was this belief that guys wrote hard jokes that made you laugh, while women wrote softer jokes that made you think, oh, how delightful.
Exactly. So how did you take that at the time when Gary Shandling told you, you write like a guy?
Well, he was one of my heroes, and There's this great documentary on HBO about him.
The Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting if you watch it is, you know, Gary is very insecure, and a lot of his jokes are about relationships. And so it only occurred to me recently that Gary wrote like a girl. And by the way, I totally mean that as a compliment.
Well, yeah, I would take that as a compliment. But getting back to when he told you about your spec script, you write like a guy. And because he was one of your heroes, at first you took that as a compliment, right? You were just so excited that he thought you were funny, right?
Yeah. Looking back, you know, it's never fun to be seen as your gender, and he certainly was singling me out that way. By the way, I grew up in this family where my aunts were really funny. I watched the Thin Man movies and thought Myrna Loy was funny, and Carol Burnett was my favorite show, and Joan Rivers was on The Tonight Show, and I thought she was funnier than Johnny Carson. So I never for a second believe that women weren't as funny as men.
Yeah, and you were right. After Gary had said that, when you left, you had this moment where you were trying to think of a better response, right? A better comeback?
Yeah, when he said, "You write like a guy," I wish I'd said, "Oh, that's just something I did in the snow once."
That's great. You wrote a freelance episode for The Simpsons, One Fish, Two Fish, Blowfish, Bluefish. And this was the first time you'd written for an animated show, right?
Oh, it was.
Was that liberating in the sense that you could let your imagination go wild without having to worry about limiting the story to a certain number of sets and worrying about production costs?
Oh, that's exactly right. Animation allows you to write a major motion picture, a budgeted TV show. And so, you know, you can cut to Homer in the sushi restaurant, and then you cut to him in the hospital, and he can make this bucket list of a dozen things he needs to do and race around and, you know, wind up in jail. So you just have endless sets and possibilities.
When that aired, was that a big highlight for you? Because The Simpsons was like this huge show.
It was. And in fact, I tend not to watch my episodes ever on the air because once they hit the air, there's nothing you can change. And that's always a little frustrating. But The Simpsons was one that I did watch with my sister Claire and her husband Rob. And one of the surprises while watching it on air was I had written a tag that had been cut for time and replaced with a very, very funny, very short tag of Homer vows that he will now live his life to the fullest.
From this day forward, I vow to live life to its fullest.
And then you cut to him sitting on the couch, eating pork rinds and watching bowling on television.
Yeah.
And one of the things in just the funny parts is I was given permission to publish the tag that was not aired. And it really ties up a lot of the storylines in the episode. So it's fun if you're a fan of the show.
What is the tag that didn't air, or do people have to read the book? Do you want
to
reveal it?
They have to read the book.
Yeah, I thought so.
I don't do a very good Homer Simpson, or I would try to do it here.
Fair enough. In July 1990, you got a job as a writer for Late Night with David Letterman, and you were only the second female writer ever hired there. So it must have been a very exciting day when you were walking into 30 Rockefeller Center on your first day at work. Can you tell me about that first day? What do you remember about it?
I was living the Liz Lemon dream years before she was created. Yeah, you walk to 30 Rock and, you know, you feel like you've been accepted into this amazing club. You know, so many of my favorite writers had passed through that show. It was really my dream job. I had already worked in LA on sitcoms, so I took this huge 75% pay cut to go back to New York and work for Late Night Variety. But Dave Letterman was the funniest person on TV.
Yeah.
And this voice of the generation. Yeah, it was very, very exciting.
Yeah. You had a disturbing experience on your first day when you were chatting with a new colleague. Can you tell me about the conversation?
Well, I wouldn't say it was disturbing. It was very odd.
So odd, okay.
He stopped by my office to say hi. And then at the end of our brief conversation says to me, before this is over, I will see a tampon fall out of your purse. It was weird.
Yeah. How did you react at the time when he said that?
Well, at the time, I kind of just thought, well, that's a strange thing to say.
Yeah.
And over the years, I would tell friends this story to try to figure out what he meant by it. And it was only decades later, when I was working on Lean In with Sheryl Sandberg, that I learned about this thing called stereotype threat. And this is when we have all this bias in our culture and it gets internalized. So they've done studies where when boys and girls take math tests, if you ask them to answer the question, what is your gender, before they take the test, girls will perform worse on those exams because being reminded of their gender and that girls don't do as well in math creates anxiety, which prohibits them from doing their job as well as they could. So I think it's possible. I don't think it was conscious, but I think subconsciously he wanted to remind me of my gender and this myth that women aren't as funny as men, and to kind of throw me off my game.
Yeah. And did that throw you off your game? What was your experience like working on Late Night with David Letterman?
There were parts of the job I absolutely loved. You know, in the afternoon, we would get our top 10 topic, and you would go into your office, and for 45 minutes, you would just write all the jokes you could think of. And I still remember my very first entry into the top 10 list was for the top 10 least popular summer camps. And I slid in at number 10 with Camp Tick in beautiful Lyme, Connecticut.
That's good. That's very good. How long did you stay?
So I stayed through my first cycle, and they picked up my option to stay for another cycle. And then about a month into that, I realized I just wasn't going to thrive there. I wrote a piece in 2009 for Vanity Fair about how it was a hostile environment for women. This whole thing was kicked off by Letterman going on air in 2009 and stating bluntly, I have had sex with women I work with.
So you were there, what, 8 months, 5 months only or something?
5 months, I think.
Did you meet with David to tell him you were quitting?
I was called into his office after I told the head writer, was Steve O'Donnell, that I was leaving the show. Yeah, I mean, back then, Dave did know all the writers by names and had some connection with them. You know, I thought about telling him that the show was a hard place for me to work, but I chickened out and I just said I missed L.A.
Hmm. You mentioned that writing the essay for Vanity Fair 19 years later, that must have been a tough decision to make. Was it something you kind of struggled with? Gee, should I do this? Is it going to have a negative effect on my career? Am I still going to be able to get work? Did you worry about that kind of thing?
I did. So the book is divided into sections, which are based on this old showbiz joke that a friend told me using my name. So the joke is, what are the four stages of a Hollywood writer's career? Stage one, who is Nell Scovell? Stage two, get me Nell Scovell. Stage three, get me a younger, cheaper Nell Scovell. And stage four, who is Nell Scovell?
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is, at the end of this joke, you return to obscurity. And what I realized is that question of who is Nell Scovell became an existential one for me. And it became, what do I stand for and who do I stand with? So in 2009, I wanted to make this point, not just about sexual harassment and sexual favoritism, but to pivot to gender discrimination in the writers' room. Because at that time, both Letterman and Leno had zero female writers.
Wow.
And I also want to add, in 33 years on the air, the Letterman writers' room never included a single person of color.
Wow.
So I stood up and I spoke out about this oversight and pointed out that you literally couldn't do worse when it came to diversity. And I did think it could end my career, and it ended up being one of the best things I ever did.
Hmm. Yeah, that's great. And you know, that joke you just referenced, I think we might have to add a fifth stage to it, and which is a replay of number two, get me Nell Scovell.
Oh, I like that idea.
Yeah, I think so.
You loop back.
Right, exactly. We loop back because we've already looped back with the who is Nell Scovell. So it makes sense in this book. This is going to make you even more of a part of popular culture than you already are. I read in an interview you said that you think that empathy is undervalued in a lot of comedy writers' rooms. And
yeah,
I'm wondering if this means that comedy writers are creating characters who are lacking in empathy, and that the majority of characters we see are a bunch of unsympathetic, self-obsessed characters, or am I extrapolating too much here?
No, I love that theory. If I had thought of it myself, I would have put it in the book.
Put it in the paperback.
Okay.
Just give me a thanks. Thanks, Doug Gordon, at the end.
I think that's incredibly smart. You should write an op-ed about it.
Okay. Thanks, Nell. Do you have a favorite joke that you've written? That's a tough one because you've written so many.
While working on the memoir, I did go back and read some of my early scripts. And, you know, you forget what you wrote back then. And I found this exchange in a Newhart script. It didn't make it to the air, but I kind of laughed even years later at it. And it's one of these woodsmen comes in and is talking to Bob Newhart. And he says, and it hit him like a ton of sticks.
Yeah.
And Bob says, don't you mean bricks? And he says, a ton of anything still weighs a ton.
Yeah, I love that one. That's great. I can't believe they didn't use it.
I know. And it's very exemplary of my favorite kind of absurdist but logical humor.
Nell Scovell is the author of Just the Funny Parts and A Few Hard Truths About Sneaking Into the Hollywood Boys Club.
Would you like to know more?
Visit us online, wpr.org/beta. And we'd love to know what you think of the show. You can email us at beta@wpr.org. Up next, the father of Christian rock, Larry Norman. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. Have you ever heard of Larry Norman? The guy that Billboard magazine said was the most important songwriter since Paul Simon? Norman's music went on to inspire members of bands that I'm sure you've heard of. Bands like U2, The Pixies, and Guns N' Roses. I must confess that I hadn't heard of Larry Norman until I discovered Gregory Thornberry's new book, Why Should the Devil Have All the Good Music? In 1969, Norman went into Capitol Records' Hollywood studio and laid down tracks for an album that would launch a new music genre, Christian rock. Gregory Thornberry tells us why Larry Norman still matters.
Larry Norman matters now for a whole range of reasons, most of which are ancillary to the music, as good as that is. But he was a, sort of a pioneering cultural figure at a time in which there was really no space to stand in the place that he wanted to stand. He was torn between two worlds. He was torn between Christ and the devil. And he was in the secular music industry, recording records on Capitol Records and MGM Verve Records, and touring around the world to sold-out audiences. And his peers in the secular music industry respected him, like people like Bob Dylan and Paul McCartney. He was in the late 60s when he was with his band People, that he was the principal songwriter for and the lead singer for. He was opening up on bills with Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and The Doors. So he had that, but they didn't understand why he would ever want to talk about God. And on the other hand, pastors and church leaders, the vast majority of them thought rock and roll is of the devil. This is satanic music. This is the Trojan horse being brought into the church to destroy everything and take us down the primrose path to the sexual revolution and all the rest. And they thought of him as a heretic. And so he is somebody that was willing to be what I call in the book a holy fool. And a holy fool is someone who's willing to speak up on something in the public square and say something that nobody wants to hear, but eventually people wind up saying, maybe you have a point here.
Can you take me back to the first time you heard Larry Norman's music?
Yeah. The job that I got was in college was as a manager of a small FM radio station that played Christian contemporary music. And I absolutely hated everything that I heard on that station. It made my skin crawl. And it seemed like Christians were accepting the sounds kind of like as an alternative, and I just hated it. But there was a semi-professional DJ at the station that was older, and he said, there's one artist that I think you might actually like. And he pulled out a couple of records, and here I saw this, you know, odd-looking, long blonde hair guy in denim standing in Times Square with his hand on his head looking puzzled, and the album was Only Visiting This Planet. And I went to the control booth, and I lowered down the needle onto the record, and it blew me away. It was every bit as good as anything that I had listened to. The production values were great. I looked at the musicians on the record. I mean, these were people that were, you know, working in conjunction with George Martin from the Beatles, and I'm like, wait, who is this guy?
You can be a righteous rocker or a holy roller. You can be most anything. You can be Leon Russell or a super muscle. You can be a corporate king. You can be a wealthy man from Texas or a witch with heavy hexes. But without love, you ain't nothing without love.
That was my introduction to Larry Norman. It set up a time where I got into a car and drove 750 miles to go see him play in concert. And it was the combination both of the quality of the songwriting, but then also seeing him in concert where he had this sort of mesmerizing effect on the crowd. And I later, this actually didn't make the cut in the book, but Larry called it the green hand. He could stand in front of thousands of people and you could hear a pin drop. And it was a very unique quality in an artist.
What else about seeing him live? And just in general, he was known for talking a lot during his concerts and doing these kind of often funny riffs and sermonizing. And what kinds of things would he say?
Well, I mean, it was sort of psychoanalysis. On the cheap.
I saw one movie, it was like, you know, a superstar cast. All the good actors read it. You know, I doubt they read the Bible, but they all had their scripts memorized. Hmm. Have you read the Bible? No, but I've seen the movie.
He would start talking directly to the audience, and he would talk about what's going on in your own inner head space and soul space, and he would sort of challenge you, and it was usually about getting inside of why you feel so alienated from yourself and from God and from other people around you. And it wound up having this unique combination of being sort of both a lecture and sort of a concert. He would talk about sex. He would talk about institutional racism in the church. He would go through all the taboos of things that you're not supposed to talk about.
As you say, Norman was too edgy for the Jesus people, and he was too religious for the run-of-the-mill rock fans. He was someone who wasn't afraid to challenge organized religion and call them out on their hypocrisies. Can you give me a couple of examples?
Well, that was, I think, his signature achievement in his career was that he was like a John the Baptist figure, and he was challenging the church that felt like they were living in their halcyon days when he was growing up in the 1950s. That was the time they felt like everything was okay, and he's like, wait a minute, you are participating, many of your own church members in the South are participating in the KKK. And you are so out of touch with what is happening politically and socially in the society that you stand absolutely no chance of having any sort of voice in this generation. He talked about what it felt like to be a young person coming of age and being a Christian and nervous about sex and what is that about. And so he felt like the church was spending 90% of its time talking about things that someone who is not a person of faith would never even care about.
Yeah.
So he decided to talk about things that they did care about.
He released his fourth album in 1972. This one is called Only Visiting This Planet. That was your initial entry point into Larry Norman's music. You say that this album is a masterpiece. Why?
It's a masterpiece, I think, you know, in some ways because it's been recognized as such. The National Recording Registry of the Library of Congress added it into the National Archive as a, you know, distinctive signature work of American art, you know, for its contributions historically, culturally, and aesthetically. It's an album that was produced at Air Studios, which was brand new, George Martin's new studio. George Martin was too busy to produce the album himself, but he corresponded with Larry and said, let me put you in touch with this team called Triumvirate, and they produce the record. As a matter of fact, some of the photographs in the studio were taken by Linda McCartney at the time, and he performed with, John Wetton, who was the bass player for, King Crimson. And it was like top studio people. And the writing on it is just spectacular. It runs the gamut between challenging the American church and American culture at large for its easy breezy walk into warmongering with the Vietnam War. It challenges institutional racism on a song like The Great American Novel, where there's this line, you kill a black man at midnight.
Just for talking to your daughter. Then you make his wife your mistress, and you leave her without water. And the sheet you wear up on your face is the sheet your children sleep on. And at every meal, You say a prayer, you don't believe, but still you keep on.
And those sorts of lines, coupled with, you know, all-out rockers like Why Don't You Look Into Jesus, you know, that song is kind of offensive to somebody who's not a person of faith. And then it moves into commentary on American culture, the buffoonery of American politics. And then there's this gorgeous song called Pardon Me with these beautiful string arrangements that are about sort of the conflicted feelings a young person of faith might have about their first, you know, sexual encounters and is it okay to abstain?
Pardon me, kissing you like I'm afraid.
It goes a lot of different directions that rock wasn't willing to go at the time, very yeah. sensitive direction. And it was also going somewhere that the church was not willing to go. So it's a masterpiece for all those reasons.
How did the fundamentalist right wing of the American church respond to this album?
Well, they hated him. Mm-hmm. I mean, and the people that really hated him were not the Billy Grahams of the world. They liked Larry Norman, but it was the television preachers, and mm-hmm. they were just first starting out in the 70s, that said that he is like a version of the devil. He is destroying the minds of our youth.
How did Larry Norman respond to these attacks?
Larry would just make fun of these guys in concert, from everything for their comments about the length of his hair to that the flatted third in the pentatonic blues scale is the devil's interval. And he's like, oh, really? That's where the devil's eyes? And, you know, that's where communism comes out. Okay, I got it. You know, so, I mean, he was very satirical about it. And, you know, humor is the best way to defuse an enemy.
He also had this theory that you write about in your book that I found very interesting, his theory about true artists never being commercial. It's only the imitators who follow popularize, you know, and they popularize their concepts for the masses. They're the ones that do well commercially.
Yeah. No, he really felt like the job of the artist is to explore new territory and to get as close as you can to poetry. But he definitely felt like there should be this artistic impulse and you shouldn't worry about being commercial, that if you're, especially if you are following God, he will take care of you.
In 1973, Larry Norman released an album called So Long Ago, The Garden. And if I'm not mistaken, this is the album cover on which he appears naked.
Yes.
And, yeah. And this was his follow-up album to Only Visiting This Planet.
That's right.
It was the second album of a proposed trilogy. How does So Long Ago, The Garden compare to the previous album? It's quite different, isn't it?
It's very different, and it's my favorite record that Larry Norman ever did. It is, it's the production's first rate. Triumvirate was back on board as the production team. The song writing on it is very clever and very twisty. And it gets under your skin and it ends in this nightmare vampy song called Nightmare Number 71, in which California, there's an earthquake and California breaks away from the rest of the country and the rest of the country sinks and Hollywood wins. And it's just really trippy.
The California earthquake, it tore the land in half. While San Andreas cleared her throat, all her tsunami laughed. The ground began to tremble, the land began to sway, and people in the other states, they were glad they moved away. But suddenly, California just floated in a breeze, while everything that wasn't sank down into the seas.
Part of the reason why that record is like it is because Billy Graham said, you know what, you should not talk about Jesus so much. He said, try to write the best artistic statement you can and see if you can get an audience that way.
Yeah.
And then they'll follow what you believe later on. And he did it.
there are a lot of surreal lyrics and things going on too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a song called Be Careful What You Sign.
Yeah, that's a very dark song. Tell me about that one.
It's a Faustian tale. It's someone who encounters the devil. You know, he takes out a gun and he commits a murder. And at the end, he winds up killing himself. But I've seen all the letters where Larry tries to unpack what all of this surrealistic and metaphorical imagery is about. And it's like, here's what happens when you go down the road of trying to, you know, kill someone that might be able to help you, which would be Jesus, and you throw in your hat to someone who can, you know, give you the whole world, but you lose your soul. It's a song that just really kind of bothers you. It's disturbing.
I'm curious, though, since this song, he followed Billy Graham's, this album, I should say, he followed Billy Graham's advice, and the album was, for all intents and purposes, didn't have this strong religious message. I'm curious about how fans, his fans reacted. Did they feel kind of shafted that he'd sold out?
Yeah, they were thrown overboard because they said he's gone secular.
Yeah.
Larry told them that he was going to do this, and he said, I don't want it to be said that I made money off of Jesus. So I'm not going to do concerts like this anymore. So he releases So Long Ago, The Garden, and I mean, it's just like the knives came out, and all the periodicals that were promoting him before said, you know, we heard that you're not a Christian anymore. And are the rumors true? He was trying to reposition himself as a true artist, and his publicist got it, and to some extent the record company got it, but the fans didn't get it. And so it was a bad career move, even though it was artistically the best move.
One of the most intriguing things about Norman's career trajectory is that as he became more popular, the more his music started being about him instead of about Jesus.
Yeah.
And was that something he was conscious of and something that he was concerned about, that he wrestled with?
What he discovered is if he wrote about what he knew, which was his own struggles, it connected with his audience. And he would bring Jesus into it, but he used the vehicle of his own pain and suffering. And that's why I think he actually hung around for as long as he did, was because he could draw people into his own narrative, and they felt like he was talking about the same stuff that they were going through.
What is Larry Norman's legacy?
I think that it's a cautionary tale in the fact that I feel like he took risks, and I feel like we're in a very risk-averse culture. And so I think that that's part of his legacy. I mean, obviously, another big part of his legacy is that he really was an artist. He sat by his own fence post and whistled his own tune and made people pay attention to him. And we're still paying attention to him all of these years later.
What do you think Larry Norman would think of today's American evangelicalism?
I think he would be brokenhearted. There's this Pauline phrase from the New Testament, having the form of godliness but denying the power thereof. And I think he talked a lot about, you know, why are we spending multi-millions of dollars on these huge church facilities that are, you know, temples to charismatic individuals more than they are Jesus, when they're people that we know in our own city that are starving. Like, where are the priorities there? And he would sort of look at the gospel industrial complex. I think Larry would say these people that are cozying up to power are just lambs being led to slaughter because they're so close to it they can't see how the rest of the culture is looking at them and saying, if that's what it's about, I can't have anything to do with God or anything that Jesus might have said. And it may seem like a good idea at the time, but what are the long-term after effects of it, you know? Yeah. So I think he would be hot and bothered if he were around today.
Mama killed a chicken, she thought it was a duck. She put it on the table with his legs sticking up. Papa broke his glasses when he fell down drunk. Tried to drown the kitty cat, turned out to be a skunk. You gotta watch what you're doing.
Gregory Thornberry is the author of Why Should the Devil Have All the Good Music? Larry Norman and the Perils of Christian Rock. For more information about Gregory and Norman, please visit wpr.org/beta. And we'd love to hear what you think of Beta. You can get in touch with us by sending an email to beta@wpr.org.
And tomorrow is trash day, so make sure all the cans are out front.
Yes.
Now, you are under no circumstances to order any movie on demand, adult or otherwise.
Yes.
Okay, has anything that I've just said confused you?
Yes.
Silicon Valley star Jimmy O. Yang joins us right after this. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. Jimmy O. Yang is a stand-up comedian and an actor. You might know him as the app developer on HBO's hit comedy series, Silicon Valley. He's written a book called How to American, An Immigrant's Guide to Disappointing Your Parents. Jimmy became a U.S. citizen in 2015. His first trip outside the U.S. as an American citizen was to my old stomping grounds, Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. It was for a weekend stand-up comedy stint at Rumors Comedy Club. Jimmy was opening up for Sean Wayans.
Yeah, I was there for a whole weekend. We ended up doing 9 shows. So the story goes that I had my American passport. I was very confident going through the Canadian border. And then they asked you, are you here for business or pleasure? So I thought it would be easier if I just said pleasure.
Why? Because you thought it would be less bureaucratic? It would be easier?
Yeah, less bureaucratic, yeah, right. You know, or I don't have to fill out paperwork or whatever. And then she caught me. She was like, nobody comes to Winnipeg to have fun. You're definitely not here for pleasure. And then I got busted.
Yeah, yeah. I have this theory that I think the most stressful job in the world is being the director of tourism for Winnipeg. Because who wants to go to visit there? Who wants to go visit there? Even the people who live in Winnipeg are taking as many vacations as they can so that they can actually live rather than just exist. You don't live in Winnipeg. You exist.
I didn't know there's like a whole reputation around Winnipeg. I thought it was just my experience.
No, it's not just yours. And my wife, who's born and raised in Winnipeg, and part of the reason I had to spend so many years there, was she hates it. She hates it more than anyone probably because she had to grow up there. Another thing that really resonated with me in your book is early on you say that you've always felt like an outsider, even as a Chinese kid growing up in Hong Kong. Why? What do you mean?
Well, so Hong Kong used to be a British colony, has its own government and things like that. And my parents are from Shanghai, from mainland China. Hong Kong even has its own dialect. Most of China speaks Mandarin, and then there's local dialects, like my family speaks Shanghainese. Mm-hmm. So my parents spoke Cantonese, which is the Hong Kong dialect, with a Shanghainese accent. And they used to always make fun of him, make fun of my dad, like he's a mainland guy, and then they'll make fun of me like I'm the Shanghai boy. Mm-hmm. So even we're kind of technically in the same country, you know, but it's still a different place, that's Hong Kong. So that was like some early lessons in like assimilation because I was not the Hong Kong kid, really, even though I was born and raised there.
Mm-hmm. How difficult was that when you first arrived?
That was kind of crazy, man. You when I was going through it, I wasn't thinking about it. I was just kind of living it day by day. But it just challenges every day, you know. Moving here, first of all, you lost all your friends that you've made from age 1 to 13 in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. And this was before FaceTime, before Skype. So you have to long-distance call them, which is very hard, and then we lost touch. Yeah. And then you got to try to make new friends and try to learn a new language and really try to fit into a new culture. So it was very difficult. And just step by step, I try to make myself as American as possible, and a lot of it I learned from watching television, you know?
Yeah, especially black entertainment television, right? Can you tell me about that, the kind of stuff you watched there that helped you to learn English?
Yeah, BET.
Yeah.
So BET obviously wasn't a thing in China, and hip-hop wasn't really a thing. neither was stand-up comedy. So when I saw BET Rhapsody and BET Comic View, it was just like these new art forms, and everybody seemed so, like, having so much fun, and it's so animated and cool. And it was like, to me, that was the coolest thing of America when I watched, like, Jay-Z's Big Pimpin' music video. Mm. And that was, like, the version of America that I looked up to, that I wanted. So I really started emulating that, and I learned a lot of English language and culture from, you know, BET.
Yeah. Now, you attended UC San Diego, and Mike Judge, who at that time was known primarily for being the creator of Beavis and Butthead, he gave the commencement address at your graduation ceremony because he was a UCSD grad. What impact did his speech have on you?
It was a pretty big impact, I think, because my parents growing up, my dad used to always tell me, you know, pursuing what you love is how you become homeless.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Very old school Chinese parent mentality. Well, I'm sure a lot of parents are like that, too. So Mike's speech was about how he was a physics major, graduated in UCSD, like I was about to, and he hated it. And then he eventually, you know, found his passion in comedy and became the success that he is now. So just seeing like a real life specimen, an example that kind of went through what I went through in the same shoes that I was in, making it, it's like, oh my God, this is possible. Just seeing that possibility, I think, is so important.
Yeah.
I think mentoring people, half of the battle is just showing them an example that, oh my God, this guy did it, and he's just like a normal guy.
Yeah. That it can be done,
Yeah, it can't be done. And it's not like he's 7 feet tall or he looks like he's built like LeBron James.
Yeah.
No, he's just a regular dude, and he did it. So for me, that kind of gave me, you know, the courage and kind of like permission that I needed to, you know, quit an internship that I hated in economics and finance and trying to really pursue what I wanted to do.
Yeah, so that was a real life-changing moment.
Yeah, for sure. And then, you know, 5-6 years later, he was the one that gave me my big break, and he had no idea I was sitting in that audience. So it was a pretty special journey.
So you decided to try stand-up. I'm curious, did pursuing a career as a stand-up comedian help you deal with feeling like an outsider here in America, in the sense that comedians tend to be outsiders themselves, and so there was this sense of belonging and community among you and your fellow comedians?
Yeah, I think it was like the first time I really felt like I really fit in, especially in America, because even high school, let's not even just talk about race, because race, like, you know, I always felt like, do I really fit in the Asian community? Or do I fit in more in the hip-hop community like that? Or am I Asian enough for the Asian community? Or am I Americanized enough for the American-born Asian communities, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when I found stand-up comedy, I realized these are all the misfits. These are all the people that didn't fit in, and they all fit in now in stand-up comedy because we didn't fit in. So that was a very special community that I found of a bunch of misfits.
Yeah, yeah. Can you tell me a bit about your early stand-up comedy? What kinds of things did you talk about?
Oh, it was horrible. It was every hack new open micer talked about the same thing, right? Like your race in a very hackney way, stuff like that. And you just try to survive that 5 minutes on stage and get a laugh, you know?
My dad is actually like a really nice guy, but he comes off wrong all the time because he's too honest, you know? Like, you guys know those people are just too honest. Like, before every one of my high school basketball games, he gave me like this pep talk. But it always came out wrong because it was just way too honest. He's like, Jimmy, you're going to play well tonight, okay? Even though you're only 5'5", you're slow as hell, and you're the weakest guy on your team. I believe in you. Now, Jimmy, shoot the ball with confidence. But don't shoot that much because your shot is horrible. Now pass to that Blackett. He's a lot better than you.
Then a few years back, I guess we're talking 5 years back, 6 years back, you crossed paths with Mike Judge again. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Yeah, so he obviously created Silicon Valley 5 years after that commencement speech. And he casted me, and that was like one of the big breaks, the big break in my career, I would think. You know, that's where probably people know of me from. And, he didn't know. He just saw my tape through an audition tape. He didn't know I went to UCSD. He didn't know I was sitting there in a commencement speech. And he casted me, man. And, and I told him the first day of table read, I was like, yo, you were the guy that was at my commencement speech that really kind of inspired me to do this. And now we became really close friends, and he's just a really down-to-earth, awesome guy. So kind of cool how that story kind of came around.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah, like something out of a Hollywood film, out of a screenplay. And tell me a bit about the character you play on Silicon Valley.
Yeah, so it's called Jing Yang, and he's an immigrant just like myself. I always felt like whenever I'm playing Jing Yang, I'm playing a version of myself 15 years ago. And the kind of cool thing about Jing Yang is he's in a bit like, okay, he has an accent. You know, on the surface, he might just seem like a stereotypical Chinese immigrant programmer. But really, as the show progressed, especially this season, he became like kind of a villain almost. And I had a lot of fun playing that.
Yeah. And you had a lot of scenes with T.J. Miller, who's no longer on the show. And the two of you have been compared to Laurel and Hardy. What do you think of that comparison?
I love it. You know, that's such a dynamic, classic duel. And something with me and T.J. just... like the modern day version of that completely just worked out, you know. He's like that big guy and I'm like that little kind of innocent guy, but somehow we love each other, but we also hate each other, and we always just throw jabs at each other. And I think the audience really liked that relationship.
What if I told you there is an app?
Jing Yang, this is the assistant. We wait for the boss to pitch. The woman you saw outside, okay?
Oh, the lady who's a smoker. You said a note.
Sorry. Monica was smoking? Cigarettes? No. He's confused. He's Chinese. Oh. Jin Yang, what are you doing? This is Palo Alto. You people are lunatics about smoking here. We don't enjoy all the freedoms that you have in China, right? Where people smoke all the time.
I don't smoke, except for special occasions.
So you do smoke? But have you been smoking in my house?
No. There's no special occasion ever happen in your house.
There's a funness behind it, and I think that's what the audience gravitated towards, and it's just kind of awesome.
Yeah. So now you're an American citizen. I'm curious, has becoming an American citizen, has that changed the way you view yourself and your identity in any way?
Not really. Mm-hmm. It was a nice honor and a stamp to be an American citizen, so it's like, it's a good moment, right?
Sure.
But at the same time, I say this in my stand-up, nothing's changed. People still see me as an Asian person, maybe Asian American at best. But nobody ever look at me in any part of the world and be like, "Look at him! Look at his cool passport! He's American."
Yeah.
You know? No.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that nothing has changed, because I'm curious about your stand-up comedy. If it's evolved in any way since you became an American citizen, because I'm wondering if you think it will evolve now because you've been in the U.S. for a while and you've become more assimilated and you won't see as many differences between your life in Hong Kong and your life here in America. Will your stand-up start becoming less personal, or am I wrong? Do you think that's not going to happen?
Well, the evolution of the stand-up, it's a slow evolution, right?
Right.
It's not like I got an American passport and I turned into a evolved Pokemon, like I went to a different form. It's not that.
Yeah.
Right? I think it's a slow growth that every artist goes through. You know, you grow more and more as you grow as a person, you grow as a stand-up. You know, and whatever experience I went through, almost getting deported from Winnipeg, you know, lying to the border security.
Yeah.
You know, that's an experience I can talk about now, and that makes me feel a certain way, and that reminds me that, oh, you know what, when the Border Patrol officer said you can go, we'll kick you back to where you came from, it don't mean China this time, it means America, and that, in a weird way, feels kind of good, you know? So experiences like that helps you grow, and I don't think it's just a passport itself, you know?
Mm-hmm, yeah. Yeah, very well said. What's next for you? You've done so much, and you're still very young. Like, what's next for you? Do you want to write? Do you want to direct? You know?
Yeah, I think I want to do all that, man. I think that's what's fun about this business. It's whatever you want to create, hopefully you can make it happen. This book is part of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going back to doing more stand-up. I'm writing a couple of scripts, and I want to turn this book into a TV show. I think that's very exciting for me.
That would be a great idea, yeah. And I was wondering, I was going to ask you if I could possibly interest you in a starring role in this new sitcom I'm developing. It's called You Must Be Trippin'. And you would play Jimmy M. Chang, the director of tourism in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. And you're stressed out because you've got the most stressful job in the world. Can I send you a script?
That's a really funny idea. I love it.
Yeah, thank you. And we wouldn't have to film. If you're interested, I know you're busy with stuff and you want to do your own stuff, we could make sure that you wouldn't have to film it in Winnipeg. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that would be the main concern, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so a final question, Jimmy. In the epilogue of your book, you say that you hit the lottery in life to have the parents that you have. Has your dad ever said anything like really poignant and touching along those lines to you?
I think, you know, he give it up every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's always more special when he gives it up. I just wrote this article for the New York Times about, you know, the American custom of saying, I love you a little too much.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I'm having lunch with a buddy that I haven't seen in 2 years, and I would say, I love you, bro.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it doesn't mean anything, you know, but in the Asian culture, we don't really say it, but when we do say it, it means so much. Now, my dad still hasn't said that to me, but sometimes he'll say, I'm proud of you.
Yeah.
And that means so much. And even though it's understood, it just feels good to hear it, you know, from him. At the end, you know, he means well and he loves me.
Jimmy O. Yang is an actor, a comedian, and the author of How to American, an immigrant's guide to disappointing your parents. That's it for this edition of Beta. Let us know what you think of the show. You can send your thoughts in an email to beta@wpr.org. And if you didn't like the show, send your thoughts in an email to betajunkfolder@wpr.org. You can become an alpha. That's what we call our beta fans. Just give us a follow on Twitter. Send a tweet to @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Special thanks to our technical director and music director, Steve Gotcher.
You're one of the most charismatic people I've ever met, and I have met Ira Glass.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
He's the least cool guy I've ever met.
And thanks to you, our alphas. And until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
He's a good man and thorough.